Chapter 54. 400 kilometers to the west, the dawn broke absolutely still. No whisper of wind rustled the air over the empty, shapeless, and desolate sands. The only sound came from the muffled tone of the fast-attack vehicle's exhaust as it scurried across the desert like a black ant on a beach. Giordino was studying the vehicle's onboard computer that subtracted the distance traveled in a straight line from the deviations that had forced them to detour around impassable ravines and a great sea of dunes. On two occasions, they had to backtrack nearly 20 kilometers before continuing on their course again. According to the digital numbers that flashed on the small screen, it had taken Giordino and Steinholm nearly 12 hours to cover the 400 kilometers between Fort Fourreau and the Mauritanian border. Staying well clear of the railroad had cost them dearly in time lost. But too much was riding on them to risk encountering armed troops patrolling the tracks or being detected and blown to shreds by roving Malian fighter jets. The last third of the journey was over hard ground, peppered with rocks that had been polished smooth by tiny grit blown by the wind. The rocks varied in size from marbles to footballs and made driving a horror. But they never gave thought to reducing their speed. They bounced over the uneven ground at a constant rate of 90 kilometers an hour, enduring the choppy, bone-jarring ride with stoic determination. Exhaustion and suffering were overcome by thinking of what must be happening to the men and women they left behind. Giordino and Steinholm well knew that if there was any hope for them at all, the American Special Operations Forces must be found, and found quickly if a rescue mission was to reach the fort before Kazim massacred everyone inside. Giordino's promise to return by noon came back to haunt him. The prospect looked dim indeed.
"How far to the border?" asked Steinholm in English with an Arnold Schwarzenegger accent.
"No way of telling," Giordino answered. "They don't erect welcome signs in empty desert. For all I know, we've already crossed it."
"At least now it's light enough to see where we're going. Makes it easier for the Malians to pick us off, too."
"I vote we head north toward the railroad," said Steinholm. "The fuel gauge is touching on empty. Another 30 kilometers and we'll have to walk."
"Okay, you sold me."
Giordino checked the computer once more and pointed toward the compass mounted above the instrument panel. "Turn on a heading of 50 degrees northwest and run a diagonal course until we bisect the track bed. That will give us a few more kilometers in case we haven't passed into Mauritania yet."
"The moment of truth," Steinholm said, smiling.
He jammed the pedal to the floor, spinning the wheels in the rock and sand, showering the air with pebbles and dust. In unison, he twisted the wheel and sent the military version of the dune buggy tearing over the desert toward Massard's railroad. The fighters returned at 11 o'clock and resumed devastating the already wrecked fort with their missiles. When they finished their bomb runs, the four tanks took up the bombardment as the desert echoed with the constant rumble of explosives. To the defenders, the thunder and devastation never seemed to end as Kazim's ground forces moved to within 300 meters and blasted away at the ruins with mortars and sniper fire. The concentration of firepower was unlike anything the French Foreign Legion had ever experienced fighting the Tuaregs during their 100-year occupation of West Africa. Shell after shell rained down, the detonations merging in a never-ending clap of thunder. The remnants of the walls continued to be pulverized from the constant explosions that hurled stone, mortar, and sand high into the air until little of the old fort bore any resemblance to its original shape. It now looked like a ruin from antiquity. General Kazim's command aircraft had landed at a nearby dry lake. Accompanied by his chief of staff, Colonel Sgir Chaik, and Ismail Yerli, he was met by Captain Mohammed Batuta. The captain led them to a four-wheel drive staff car and drove them to the hastily set up headquarters of his field commander, Colonel Nuhum Mansa, who stepped forward to greet them.
"You have them completely hemmed in?" Kazim demanded.
"Yes, General," Mansa quickly answered. "My plan is to gradually compress our lines around the fort until the final assault."
"Have you attempted to persuade the UN team to surrender?"
"On 4 different occasions, each time I was flatly rejected by their leader, a Colonel Levant."
Kazim smiled cynically.
"Since they insist on dying, we'll help them along."
"There cannot be many of them left," observed Yerli as he peered through a telescope mounted on a tripod.
"The place looks like a pulverized sieve.
They must all be buried under the stone from the fallen walls.
My men are anxious to fight, said Mansa. They wish to put on a good show for their beloved leader.
Kazim looked pleased.
And they shall have their opportunity. Give the order to charge the fort in 1 hour.
There was no pause from the incessant hammering. Down in the arsenal, now crammed with nearly 60 commandos and civilians, the stones supporting the arched roof, their mortar crumbling, began falling on the huddled mass of people below. Eva was crouched near the stairway, bandaging a female fighter whose shoulder was punctured in several places by small shrapnel, when a mortar shell burst at the head of the upper entrance. Her body shielded the woman she was tending as the blast mauled her with flying rock. She lost consciousness and awoke later to find herself laid out on the floor with the other wounded. One of the medics was at work on her as Pitt sat and held her hand, his face tired, streaked with sweat, and wearing a stubble of beard turned nearly white with billowing dust, lit up with a loving smile.
"Welcome back," he said. "You gave us quite a scare when the stairway caved in."
"Are we trapped?" she murmured.
"No, we can break out when the time comes."
"It seems so dark."
"Captain Pembroke Smythe and his team cleared an exit only big enough for us to breathe. It doesn't let in much light, but it keeps out the shrapnel."
"I feel numb all over. How strange, there is no pain."
The medic, a young red-headed Scotsman, grinned at her. "I've heavily sedated you. I couldn't have you waking up on me while I set your lovely bones."
"How bad am I?"
"Except for a broken right arm and shoulder, one or more cracked ribs, I can't tell without x-rays, fractured left tibia and ankle, plus a sea of bruises and possible internal injuries, you're quite all right."
"You're very honest," said Eva, gamely forcing a thin smile at the medic's battlefield whimsy.
The medic patted her good arm. "Forgive my bleak bedside manner, but I think it's best you know the cold truth."
"I appreciate that," she said weakly.
2 months' rest, and you'll be ready to swim the channel."
"I'll stick to heated swimming pools, thank you."
Pembroke Smythe, indefatigable as ever, moved about the crowded arsenal, keeping everyone's spirits up. He came over and knelt by Eva.
"Well, well, you're one iron lady, Dr. Rojas."
"I'm told I'll survive."
"She won't be engaging in wild and crazy sex for a while," teased Pitt.
Pembroke Smythe made a comic leer.
"What I wouldn't give to be around when she recovers."
Eva missed the captain's sly innuendo. Almost before he finished his remark, she had slipped back into unconsciousness. Pitt and Pembroke Smythe stared over her into each other's eyes, the faces suddenly devoid of humor. The captain nodded at the automatic pistol slung under Pitt's left arm.
"In the end," he said quietly, "will you do her the honor?"
Pitt nodded solemnly. "I'll take care of her." Levant came up, looking grimy and tired. He knew his men and women could not endure this punishment much longer. The added burden of watching the suffering of women and children wrenched at his tough professional spirit. He hated to see them and his beloved tactical team being mercilessly subjected to such torment. His coldest fear was being overrun when the bombardment stopped, and then watching helplessly as the Malians ran amok in butchery and rape. His best guess of the force against them was between 1,000 and 1,500. The number of his men and women still capable of fighting was down to 29, including Pitt. And then there were the 4 tanks to contend with. He had no idea how long they could hold out before being overrun. An hour, maybe 2, more likely less. They would make a fight of it, that much was certain. The bombardment had oddly worked in their favor. Most of the rubble from the walls had fallen outward, making it difficult for assaulting troops to climb over it.
"Corporal Wadalinsky reports the Malians are beginning to form up and move in," he said to Pembroke Smythe. "The assault is imminent. Widen the entrance to the stairs and have your people ready to move out the instant the firing stops."
"Right away, Colonel."
Levant turned to Pitt.
"Well, Mr. Pitt, I believe the time has arrived to test your invention."
Pitt stood and stretched. "I wonder it hasn't been blown to splinters.
When I gave a quick look above ground a few minutes ago, it was still sitting in one piece under a section of one wall that was still standing.
Now that's enough to get me to quit drinking tequila."
Nothing so drastic as that, I hope.
Pitt looked into Levant's eyes. Mind if I ask what your answer was to Kazim's surrender demands?
The same reply we French gave at Waterloo and Cameroon. Merde.
In other words, crap, Pembroke Smythe translated.
Levant smiled. A polite way of putting it.
Pitt sighed. I never thought Mrs. Pitt's boy would end up like Davy Crockett and Jim Bowie at the Alamo.
Taking into account our small number and the enemy's firepower, said Levant,
I'd have to say our odds of surviving are no better and probably worse. A silence fell so abruptly that it seemed a great blanket was thrown over the underground arsenal. Everyone froze and looked up at the ceiling as if they could see through 3 meters of rock and sand. Holed up and pounded for 6 hours, the members of the tactical team who could still stand and fight threw aside the rubble that sealed the entrance, poured into the heat and scorching sun, and spread out through the ruins. They found the fort almost unrecognizable. It looked like a warehouse after a demolition crew had finished with it. Black smoke spewed up from the burning personnel carriers, and all buildings had been almost completely flattened. Bullets were whining and ricocheting through the heaps of jumbled stone like crazed hornets. The UN team was sweating from the Saharan heat, dirty, hungry, and dead tired. But they were totally devoid of fear and madder than hell at having taken everything the Malians had thrown at them without responding.
Short on everything, but not fighting guts, they took up their defensive positions, coldly swearing to make their attackers pay a heavy price before the last of them fell. On my command, maintain a clear, steady fire, ordered Levant over his helmet radio. Kazim's battle plan was ridiculously simple, calling for the tanks to break through the battered main gate on the north wall while the assault troops charged from all sides. Every man at his command was to be thrown into battle, all 1,470 of them. None would be kept in reserve. I expect all-out victory with no quarter, Kazim told his officers. Shoot down any of the UN commandos who attempt to escape. No prisoners, Colonel Trike asked in surprise. Do you think that wise, my general? You see a problem, old friend. When the international community finds out we executed an entire United Nations force, there could be serious countermeasures taken against us. Kazim drew himself up. I have no intention of allowing hostile incursion across our borders to go unpunished. The world will soon learn that the people of Mali are not to be treated like desert vermin. I agree with the general, said Yerli on cue. The enemy of your people must be destroyed. The excitement within Kazim was more than he could contain. He had never led troops into battle before. His rapid advancement and power had come from devious manipulations. He did little more than order others to kill those who presented opposition. Now he pictured himself as a great warrior about to charge foreign infidels. Order the advance, he ordered. This is a historic moment. We engage the enemy. The assault troops ran across the desert in the classic infantry textbook attack, dropping to provide covering fire for other advancing members of the force, then rising and coming on again. The first wave of elite troops began shouting boldly after they reached within 200 meters of the fort without receiving enemy fire. Ahead of them, the tanks had failed to fan out properly and came on in a staggered formation. Pitt decided to try for the one bringing up the rear. With the help of 5 commandos, he pulled the debris off the spring bow and dragged it to an open area. On the ancient siege engines, the tension would have been taken up by a windlass and tackle. But on Pitt's model, the forklift was tipped over so that its twin lifting prongs could pull the springs of the bow back on a horizontal line. As one perforated drum of diesel fuel was loaded on the spring bow, 5 more, consisting of Pitt's entire supply of missiles, were lined up alongside. Come on, baby, he muttered as the starter kicked over the forklift's bulky engine. Now is not the time to get finicky. Then came a coughing through the carburetor, and the exhaust popped and settled in a steady roar. Earlier, during the pre-dawn darkness, Levant had left the fort and set stakes in the sand around its perimeter for a firing mark. To have waited until the defenders saw the whites of the attackers' eyes would have meant certain death. The odds were simply too overwhelming to allow close-in fighting. Levant set the stakes at 75 meters. Now, as the tactical team waited to open up, every eye was on Pitt. If the tanks could not be stopped, the Malian assault troops would have little to do but mop up. Pitt took a knife and cut an elevation mark on the spot where the ends of the bent springs met the launch plank as an indicator to judge tension for distance. Then he climbed on one of the support beams and stared at the tanks again. "Which one are you aiming for?" asked Levant. Pitt pointed to the lagging tank on the left end of the line. "My idea is to start at the rear and work forward." "So the tanks in front don't know what's happening behind," mused Levant. "Let's hope it works." The blazing heat from the sun radiated on the armored contours of the tanks. Supremely confident they would find nothing but already dead bodies, the tank commanders and their drivers rolled forward with open hatches, their guns throwing shells against the few remaining ramparts of the fort. When Pitt could almost make out the individual features of the lead tank's driver, he lit a torch and pressed the flaming end against the leaking oil on top of the punctured drum. Flame burst immediately. Then Pitt jammed the torch in the sand and yanked on the line that released the trigger catch he had built from a door latch. The taut nylon line and cable holding the springs whipped free, and the truck springs snapped straight. The flaming drum of diesel oil flew over the ravaged wall like a fiery meteor and sailed high over the rear tank, striking the ground a considerable distance to its rear before exploding. Pitt stood amazed. "This thing does the job better than I ever imagined," he muttered. "Down 50 meters and 10 to the right," observed Pembroke Smythe as nonchalantly as if he was relating a soccer score. As Levant's men helped hoist another barrel in place, Pitt cut a new mark on the launch plank to adjust for the distance. Next, he engaged the forklift's hydraulics, bending back the spring bow again. The torch was applied, the trigger mechanism was unleashed, and the second oil drum was on its way. This one struck a few meters in front of the rear tank, bounced, and then rolled underneath and between the treads before exploding. The tank was instantly enveloped in flames. The crew, in their desperation to abandon the vehicle, fought each other to be first to escape through the hatches. Only 2 out of 4 made it out alive. Pitt lost no time in setting up the spring bow again. Another oil drum was manhandled into place and flung at the advancing tanks. Pitt scored a direct hit this time. The drum flew in an arc over the wall and dropped squarely on the next tank's turret, where it exploded and turned the vehicle into a blazing incinerator. "It's working, it's really working," Pitt muttered jubilantly as he readied the spring bow for the next shot.
"Jolly good show," shouted the normally reserved Pembroke Smythe. "You hit the bleeding wogs where it hurts most."
Pitt and the commandos, who struggled to hoist the next oil drum on the launch plank, didn't need any urging. Levant climbed to the only undamaged parapet and surveyed the battlefield. The unexpected destruction of 2 of Kazim's tanks had temporarily halted the advance. Levant was highly pleased with the initial success of Pitt's machine, but if only 1 tank survived to reach the fort, it was enough to spell disaster for the defenders. Pitt triggered the release mechanism for the 4th drum. It flew true, but the tank commander, now aware of the fiery onslaught from the fort, ordered his driver to zigzag. His caution paid off as the drum's trajectory carried it 4 meters behind the left rear tread. The drum burst, but only a portion of the blazing liquid splashed on the armored tail of the tank, and the monster relentlessly pressed on toward the fort. To the fighters crouched amid the rubble, the approaching horde of Malians looked like an army of migrating ants. There were so many, so bunched together, it would be nearly impossible to miss. The Malians, shouting their individual war cries, came on firing steadily. The first wave was only a few meters from Levant's firing stakes, but he held off giving the order to fire, guardedly hopeful that Pitt could take out the 2 remaining tanks. His wish was answered as Pitt, anticipating the tank commander's next change in course, adjusted his spring bow accordingly and laid his 5th flaming missile almost into the driver's front hatch. A sheet of fire covered the front of the tank, and then, incredibly, it blew up. The entire advance halted as they all stared in astonishment at the tank's turret that was thrown whirling high into the desert sky before falling and embedding itself in the sand like a leaden kite. Pitt was down to his last drum of diesel oil. He was so exhausted now with the physical effort in the body-sapping heat, he could hardly stand. His breath came in great heaves, and his heart was pounding from the continuous strain of helping manhandle the heavy drums onto the launching plank, and then straining to shift the spring bow and its supports for aiming. The huge 60-ton tank loomed through the dust and smoke like an immense steel gargoyle searching for victims to consume. The tank's commander could be seen giving orders to his driver and directing his gunner as his machine gun opened up at point-blank range. Everyone in the fort tensed and held their breath as Pitt lined up the spring bow. Many thought the end had come. This was his final shot, the last of the oil-filled containers. No football place kicker ever had more riding on a field goal in overtime play to win a game. If Pitt misjudged, a lot of people were going to die, including himself and those children down in the arsenal. The tank came straight on, its commander making no attempt to dodge. It was so close that Pitt had to elevate the rear of the spring bow to depress the launch plank. He kicked the trigger and hoped for the best. The tank's gunner fired at the same moment. In a fantastic freak of coincidence, the heavy shell and the flaming drum met in midair. In his excitement, the gunner inside the tank had loaded an armor-piercing shell that bored right through the drum, causing a great sheet of fiery oil to spray all over the tank. The steel monster immediately became lost in a curtain of fire. In panic, the driver threw the tank in reverse in a vain attempt to escape the holocaust, colliding with the burning tank behind. Locked together, the great armored vehicles quickly became a raging conflagration, punctuated by the roar of their exploding shells and fuel tanks. The commandos' cheers rose above the sound of the incoming gunfire. Their worst fears eliminated by Pitt's scratch-built spring bow, their morale at a fever pitch, they became more determined than ever to make a fight of it. Fear did not exist in battered old Fort Faureau this day. "Pick your targets and commence firing," Levant ordered in a formal tone. "Now it's our turn to make them suffer."